Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover World podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. You may be familiar with Greek mythology, but have you encountered the trickster Anansi or the Orisha? In this episode, authors Ashley Thorpe and Chika Dilley and Mela Madu, a novelist, poet and playwright, Inua Elams, celebrate the extraordinary tales of West African mythology. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, our panel will guide you through the mythological wonders of West Africa and the work inspired by them.
Hello and good evening. My name is Chika Dilley Melamado and welcome to our Orishas talk. The Orishas are a bunch of Yoruba gods or Yoruba deities, but we'll be covering the whole of West Africa. My book, Dazzling, was my first novel, was published last year in 2013 by Headline Publishers. And this is my first time in Bradford, so I'm glad to be here. Yay!
My name is Inua. I write stuff. I came all the way from London today. I've been sleeping rather poorly for the last three nights. I don't know why. I went to a house party yesterday, and as I walked up the stairs, I remember telling my girlfriend, I said, I bet I'll have an ex here. And she said, oh, don't be ridiculous. But I walked in, and guess who was sat prime? But fortunately, we parted on good terms. So it was a lovely reunion. Her name is Connie. She's absolutely lovely. She has a lovely four-year-old son now.
Are you saying all this because we are being recorded?
Are we being recorded?
Yeah.
No.
Do you not know?
No, I don't like to read my bio, so I just waffle until someone tells me to stop. That's
don't
what
worry,
I was
Connie,
doing.
Connie will get
it. Connie gets it, yeah. So, hi, nice to meet you.
Hey, hello, I'm Ashley Thorpe. My debut book, The Boy to Be the Gods, comes out on Thursday. So, brand new. Thank you, really appreciate it. I think it's about to be the maddest couple of weeks of my life. My publisher is Osborne, and I do middle grade, so 9+, basically. I always say I write for children, well, but adults as well, so people who are young at heart, basically. It's writing. As an adult, I feel like you always inject a bit of your life and your experience into things, so there'll be a lot that resonates with elders as well. I'm from Manchester. I can't remember if I said that or not, but 50-minute journey as opposed to a day's travel forever from like East Sussex. So, yes.
Nice. I didn't talk about my book. this book came out 4 or 5 years, 2019. It's called The Half God of Rainfall. It's an epic poem, which is also a play. It was performed in London at the Kiln Theatre and in New York at the New York Theatre Workshop. And another production will be there at the start of the year. It's a poem about love and basketball, which is also a really brilliant movie, which I recommend that you watch.
So what was your kind of gateway god? What was the god or what was the mythology or pantheology that caused your interest in gods?
His name is Logan. Is popularly known as Wolverine. Yes. Yeah. He's technically immortal.
Yeah.
He has healing abilities. Yeah. He's part of a pantheon of other meta-human known as the X-Men. There's one called Cyclops. There's one called Angel who looks like an angel. He has wings and stuff.
And then Jean Grey, simply called Jean Grey.
Yeah, also known as the Phoenix, when she releases her dark
energies. And Storm is...
And
Orisha anyway, it is like, right? She's basically Oya.
There's one thing that pisses me off about Storm is that her name is Ororo, which means oil.
Yeah.
Which, anyway.
It's close, but no.
And what about you, Ashley? What was your first God crush?
God crush?
Yeah.
I mean, I was raised in a church as a kid, but I wouldn't call that a crush. very different experience. For me, I think it was probably, like, I remember studying the Norse gods at school, but I think it was most likely Greek pantheon. It was most likely like Zeus and his bunch of, gods who went up against the Titans. All of that, I was fascinated with all of that as a kid. So I watched Jason and the Argonauts and was super into the Trojan War and stuff, all of that good stuff. So that for me was it. So that was probably my entrance, I think, yeah.
I think that probably was my entrance as well, except I had the corresponding Roman pantheon.
Okay, right,
my parents were very much into reading and imbibing the Encyclopedia Britannica. And that had all of that stuff in there. Okay. And it took me a while because of the dichotomy between the things that we read growing up and the things that we watched growing up and what was obtainable in our rural villages. It took me a while to realize that the gods of our forefathers were also part of a pantheon. Mm-hmm. And they were also gods because they are so demonized and so sort of like you're meant to feel ashamed of them. If you believe in them, it means you're backward, you're unsophisticated, you're uneducated, you're ignorant, basically there's no hope for you in the future. And so imagine my surprise when Marvel, you know, and we have a lot more interesting gods. They're not really tit for tat with the gods that we read growing up, you know, Zeus and the Roman pantheon. Mm-hmm. They're very interesting. Mm. And so the god that is the closest to my heart, as it were, is the Igbo python god. But that is for two reasons. One, in my hometown, it's the totem god, is the god that is revered the most. Mm. So the river Idemili, which she has lent, it's her name. Her name is Idemili, which means a pillar of water. If any of you have read Achebe, Idemili is mentioned in Things Fall Apart. And so Idemili is a god that arose out of nature itself. You know, she wasn't created by man to serve a particular need because water is as old as the earth itself. And so Idemili was the closest to me because she's the god of my hometown. But more importantly, out of the 9 villages in my hometown that form my hometown, I'm from the smallest village where the priesthood comes from. Mm. So anybody that is supposed to serve Idemili as a priest comes from my village as the youngest brother. And so for me, it's sort of the interest in Igbo gods came about that way because it was very much go back to the village and don't talk to that person because he still worships that god, you know, or don't eat in that person's house because we don't know what he's doing. And so it was much closer for me. And it was very difficult it wasn't until I became maybe a teenager or maybe in your early 20s that you begin to sort of like merge both of them and realize that actually there's nothing wrong with it.
In fact,
I think that the Igbo way of life is to be admired when it comes to the way that we treat our gods, because if your gods don't perform, if it's not an elemental god, for instance, if it's a god that is a sub-god or a sub-deity, you know, like how you have in Shinto, you have a god of everything, the god of this shoe, the god of this chair, you know, if it's a god that doesn't perform after much sacrifice, you have the right to throw it down, burnish shrines, obliterate it, and create for yourself a new god. And so I think that irreverence of Igbo-ness, which is the reverence that I didn't talk about my book, did I?
You didn't.
Okay, so this is my book, Dazzling. And the irreverence of my characters, people say, who is your antagonist? There's no antagonist. There are two protagonists in here. The irreverence of the both of them, they're having to deal with matters that are far beyond their age and they're far beyond their capability, having to take care of the adults in their lives, having to take on the spirits and the supernatural, that irreverence and strength comes from the ability to look a god in the face and say, actually, you're not serving me, so goodbye. And that's where my interest came from.
This explains Igbo people.
Yes.
Yeah, the Igbos are very fierce.
I am Igbo, yes.
Hausa.
But it is interesting, like
the no Yorubas here, but we are all taking all the Yoruba girls. But Ashley is probably Yoruba because he's 76% what, Nigerian? So yay. So there are 3 Nigerians here, really.
But no, it is interesting, as you say, in your village and how gods are perceived in these rural spaces. When you directly compare that to how revered the Greek canon is and how respected, especially at an academic level as well, right? There is something interesting about that and how gods from the European canon are seen compared to how Africans are and how indeed Africans themselves, you know, see it as well, right?
Yeah, but that could be also something that, and I talk about this a bit in the way that Dazzling is structured, because it's very much a rural versus town or city ideology.
Yeah.
And part of that came with the fact that when the missionaries came with their education and their sugar, because there was a lot of sugar, they came with sugar and they came with all these white towels and it was like, oh my God, it's so white and it's sugar. But when they came, the structure and the hierarchy of the society, of Igbo society, was turned on its head. So people who were so-called servants of gods, right? So people who are not allowed to intermarry with other people, for instance, because they're servants of God, or people who had been taken as slaves from other conquests and brought back and were not allowed to marry the freeborn people in the area, they ran first and joined the church. So the minute they joined the church, they were directly affiliated with the British government, which meant that they were suddenly placed high above the titled men and the priests and the chiefs and people who had achieved all this stuff. And so it flipped the system on its head. And because of that, because there was also an economic reason for these gods to die and for their followers to also be, you know, to be reduced. That's why that whole thing came absolutely. About. Because then those people who were first to enter the church became the catechists, became the lay readers, became the teachers, and also became the court messengers and district court messengers as well. So they were responsible for tax, you know, people who were considered uninitiated in the ways of manhood or in the ways of like the spirits or in the ways of the gods would then be in charge of going to a chief's house and looking him in the eye and be like, the queen says you must give me your money, you know. And it was such a, it was a bruise to the ego of these men. But by and large, what has happened is that the system has turned around. And so those people fell out of favor. They became people who didn't have Western education, for instance. And that affected also the gods that they served.
The long-lasting effects of colonialism and colonial mindset.
Yes.
And that's traveled just like me. So African diaspora, obviously, West African via the Caribbean, now in the UK, like second generation. But that mindset traveled with it. So in Jamaica, where my grandparents migrate from, heavily Christian. But yeah, there was a time where there would have been the Ghanaian gods or the Nigerian gods that traveled with them and completely lost. So to my generation, again, completely lost, which is why doing the research for things like this, just taking back all that information that's been lost to me over time. And that's been really fulfilling for me. It's been really rich.
Mine was... and my father was a Muslim when he married my mother, who was a Christian. And I was a kid, I used to go to the mosque and to the church. So the religion, the systems of belief I was introduced to were both foreign, as in one was from the Middle East, well, both were from the Middle East, but one was more westernized than the other.
Yeah.
From there, I discovered Marvel Comics and those pantheons. And when we left Nigeria, I came to the UK, was when I discovered the Greek gods and the Roman gods. And then I became fascinated with them. And when I got the idea for this story, I initially wanted, basically, there was a girl. There's always a girl. And I wanted to play basketball, and I was terrible at it. And I developed asthma. I couldn't play basketball again, blah, blah, blah. And when I got the idea for this story, I wanted this kid to be able to do the things that I could never do as a kid. And because of that, I thought he needs superhuman abilities. And then I naturally thought about Zeus because I was educated about Zeus. Mm-hmm. Nothing about any African or sub-Saharan gods. So I began to research into Zeus as a father figure. And that's when I discovered that he was...
A slut.
Right.
Not just a slut, he was a sexual predator.
He was
a serial rapist.
Yeah, he was bad.
Once I saw that, I couldn't unsee it.
Right.
And the first thing I thought was, why did I go to Zeus? Why didn't I think about any of the gods in Nigeria? And then I began to research and rediscovered the Igbo pantheon, the Yoruba pantheon, and also the Hausa pantheon. Mm. And I should have written about the Hausas, but I don't speak Hausa. Right, and not much have been translated into English, therefore I chose to write about the Orishas instead. So they are battling against the Olympians in my book.
And it's interesting, right, how many crossovers there actually are between all these different pantheons, right? So you mentioned it's like Zeus and his thunderbolts, and then there's obviously Shango, and then there's obviously...
Amadioha.
Yeah, exactly, as well. And even Thor with his hammer and lightning, right? So yeah, there's all of these kind of crossovers in different cultures. So that was fascinating how you brought it together, actually.
There's actually a book, which I didn't buy because it was way too expensive. But it's one in which Plato is compared to...
Aurimila?
Yes, Aurimila, yeah. There's a book in which, because of everything Plato, you know, stands for with regards to Greek knowledge and wisdom, blah, 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 Aurimila is the other. And they compare their philosophies. There was this attempt to create parallels between them so that the ways in which they're conceived of in the sort of South Pan-African mindset, or Nigeria specifically, their equivalents, false equivalents, made between that and Western religious belief systems.
Well, tell us a bit more about your book.
Yeah.
Before you do a little bit of reading. He took my copy, so this is actually mine. because I was reading it on the train and I couldn't get enough of it. But tell us a little bit about the book. What like, in as a synopsis, what is your book about? Should I just read it from the book? Should I just read the synopsis?
Yes. Oh, yeah, there's one here.
There is.
Yes. there is something about Demi. When this boy is angry, rain clouds gather. When he cries, rivers burst their banks. And the first time he takes a shot on a basketball court, the deities of the land take note. His mother, Modupe, looks on with a mixture of pride and worry. She knows gods often act like men. The same fragile egos, the same unpredictable fury, and the same sense of entitlement to the bodies of mortals. She will sacrifice everything to protect her son, but she knows the gods will one day tire of sports fans, their fickle allegiances and misdirected prayers. When that moment comes, it won't matter how special he is. Only the women in Demi's life, the mothers, daughters, and goddesses, will stand between him and the lightning bolts. That's really well written.
Yeah.
Someone knew what they were doing. Wow.
You look surprised.
Yes, so, I've never read this.
So the god of...
Half god of rainfall.
The half god of rainfall.
Yes.
I found the character of Demi very interesting in the way that he's not particularly seen as masculine at first.
Yeah.
Why did you write him that way? Seeing the society in which he is based, of course, and how masculinity, however it presents, is revered. Why did you present him as somebody who is not particularly masculine?
Like Ashley said, you sort of put yourself in your books in some way, shape, or form. I have three sisters. I'm the only male child in my family. And what it meant to be a good brother was to play with my sisters, which meant doing things that boys would not traditionally do. So I grew up playing with dolls and sewing doll dresses and all of those things. But I never questioned that when I was a kid. I just, you know, we really believed in democracy in my household. So I, you know, my father didn't dictate what happened. I just did what my sisters did. And when I was emotional and crying, my sisters would never say, stop acting like a girl, because they were girls.
Yeah.
So all of that language didn't exist in my childhood. And it was only when we left Nigeria and came here that I, you know, all of these sort of language was used to describe the way that I was acting. So I don't know, all of that. So when I wrote about Demi, I just wrote about myself. So he's emotional because he's emotional. Mm. That isn't gendered, you know, so yeah.
And are you writing about yourself in The Boy to Beat the Gods?
Not really, no. It's complete opposite, really. I wouldn't say really. I mean, you obviously put different parts of yourself into every character, really. Someone, a kid actually asked me, I was doing World Book Day this year, he asked me if there are any characters that like I thought were based on me or more like me. But character, well, the god Eshu, let's say, he's manifest as Echo in my version of the story. And he's just a silly character. He's just a trickster god.
Yeah.
But he's also quite an earnest character as well. And he's learning a lot about himself in this. He's kind of a crossroads god, but he finds himself at a crossroads against the other Ishas in the story. So I feel like he's kind of a big brother figure as well. So he's kind of like, has a little bit of me in there. But that's really as far as it goes. And then I just observations. So there'll be people probably like reading this, and I think the first copies have gone out to people who've pre-ordered now, who might see themselves or maybe members of family or friends in there and say, like, that's this guy.
So yeah. Can you give
wait,
us...
Wait. Oh, sorry. Yunko, are you in your book?
Am I in my book? How dare you? I do not want to answer that. I think everybody does put some bits of themselves. I think that even when I don't think that I'm in my book, there are parts of me that might be there. But I think the one thing I was very conscious of putting in my book is, you know, Zemena, the girl who inherits the leopard legacy. So there's, in old Igbo land, right, before the advent of the white man, there were this group of people, secret society of people who believed that they would turn into leopards and they would keep the law. And it wasn't, they did more than the chiefs did. So the chiefs were there to make sure that people did not beat their wives on the week of peace and that, you know, people did not, I don't know, steal yams or whatever. But these people, their job was to punish and to sort of to ferret out proper evil doing, like the sort of evil doing that would cause chaos in the land, that will cause the crops to fail or will cause two-headed babies to be born, that sort of thing. So things like rape, for instance, they wouldn't just kill the rapist. They would make sure that everybody would just kind of like, because there's a saying in Igbo culture, when a finger is stained with palm oil, the rest of your hands are definitely going to be stained with palm oil. So they would make sure that they kind of like root you out.
They cut the hand off.
Exactly. They will kind of kill everybody. They'll make sure everybody's just done with. And so the leopard society, that sort of fell to them in that they were, killing is bad, right? And killing was considered bad in Igbo culture. But they had sort of a divine remit to kill ritualistically. Mm. It was their job to do that. But I wanted to, it was a masculine society. It was a masculine secret society. And when the British came, they terrorized the British because the British were coming to what they saw it as wreak havoc and disorder. So they terrorized them. You know, it was malaria on one hand and the leopard society on the other hand. And so when I wrote this book, I thought about what if those physical, external oppositions were not there in the kind of world that we live in now, where we're not fighting the sort of wars day to day, where we're having to fight our like raiding parties from other villages and we're having to fight for water. There are places where that happens. But if we removed it, because it's largely removed from the society in which we live, what kind of wars would we be fighting and what kind of people would be there to fight those wars? And I alighted at spiritual or supernatural warfare where there is, you know, like people talk about the Illuminati all the time. And this is not an Illuminati book, but the idea that there's a shadow sort of force that exerts itself over the world and that people like Ozemena, the leopard girl, can see and correct and balance that force because it has an influence in the world in which we live. And so that is her job. But what I wanted to show is that she couldn't have been a leopard in the way that a man would have been a leopard. So in the very beginning of the book, I say that Ozemena is the kind of child who studies the world and gives the world what she thinks it wants. And that is also her way of keeping herself safe. A lot of women keep themselves safe in that way, by making sure that they present an outward facade that is inoffensive. And while she stops short of being vanilla, she's certainly reserved. She will do all the things she's supposed to do. And that's what made her a good leopard. Someone that is used to being a second-class citizen, someone that is used to being underneath, someone that is used to being, you know, she comes from a middle-class family, so it's not as if they didn't think much of her, but the things they think about her strengths have to do with bringing glory to the family, so doing well in school, maybe making a good marriage in the future, that sort of thing. And so she's very much a different sort of leopard than the leopard that would have existed. And I think for me, it was a conscious decision to write Ozemena in the way that I want to present. I want to be that kind of person who is going to, not necessarily give the world what they want, because I'm not doing that, but who is basically able to assess and to discern where to apply force and where to apply compromise or where to apply negotiation. At the point when Ozemenas is battling with the decision of being this leopard, she asks her grandmother, but why me? Why not my sister? Because her sister is always like, beating people up and all that. Like, she has asthma, so she will beat people up so much that she will just go into an asthma attack. And her grandma was like, because she will destroy herself to destroy somebody else. Like, her wrath is too much. And you need to have that balance. And I think that a lot of women are taught that balance from an early age. They are taught, you know, the kind of strength that you have are not physical ones. You have to be cunning. You have to be smart. You have to be, you know, you have to be wily a bit. And so she's very much like that.
That's great. Great. Yeah.
So would you like to do a bit of reading from your book?
Yes.
A teeny tiny bit, just so you can get a flavor of.
Maybe I should just start at the start.
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, I know the bit I wanted to start from, but I don't know if you'll do it.
Which bit?
You know, the bit where, because it's going to lead into what I want to talk about, the bit with Zeus and Shango.
Oh, when Zeus invades Mount Olympus. Okay.
See what I mean about the strength of a woman? I'm like, please, this is what I want.
Well, I'm trying to find it.
Okay. Should I go to Ashley for a bit? Ashley, yes, do you want to read your bit? Just a little, like, 2-3 paragraph thing, please.
2-3 paragraphs, okay.
Yes.
Well, I'll start at the beginning as well.
Yes.
Because that's... Yeah, chapter's called The Great Baobab Tree. At the farthest end of the village, before the sea, a river that split the land, a lone baobab tree stood. The tree was older than any village and as tall as any clouds. Its fruit never fell from the branches and was said to have nourished the fearsome orishas in their infancy. Coyote's focus was this ripe brown fruit on his far-off branches, rather than the mischievous goats he was meant to be tending. The village elders had made it abundantly clear that the fruit was forbidden and belonged to the orishas alone. In fact, they tried to drum it into him every time he was caught climbing the great tree. But Coyote's dream of eating a fruit and becoming godlike himself had never faded. Apart from 5 other young goat herds, there was hardly a soul in the plains surrounding the tree. The sun had scorched the earth, and the wood and grass thirstily awaited the next rains. This meant that there was no long grass for a disobedient boy to hide in. It was lucky for Coyote then that the tree's elder Moyo, was sound asleep in its shade. Coyote stared at the hefty rain stick in the crook of the elder's arm and felt a bead of sweat roll down his neck. His bottom was still sore from the last time he'd attempted to climb a tree, but met Moyo's wrath instead. Nonetheless, he pointed the hand that wasn't shaking up towards the treetop. "Sisters and brothers, what day is today?" Coyote asked of anyone who'd listen. "Today is time you kept a close watch over your herd on the ground instead of on those branches in the sky," called Akufo, a herder who was much closer to being a man than he was. "Unless you're just that eager to feel the rain stick whack your backside again." I'll leave it there.
Before I go to you, I wanted to talk about the symbolism of the baobab tree and the fact that we are talking about, seems very biblical, doesn't it? This baobab tree that is supposed to be out of reach. Was it something that you did subconsciously, having grown up in the church?
I mean, it's definitely, looking back, a subconscious thing. So there's this fruit which is growing on this tree. But also the baobab tree, also known as the tree of life. I think they're stunning, beautiful trees. And they're also native to Africa, obviously, and Australia as well. But it immediately gives the impression of place. So we're in Africa, okay. We have this tree, also called the Tree of Life. So it immediately symbolizes the place where I want to set it and setting in this plains where the story begins. But also theme of life and also rebirth. We'll come into it later on as well. So yeah, those were the main reasons, really, so that symbolism.
You know, many of them are dying now.
Yeah, they are falling over, which is so sad.
Yeah.
So sad, yeah. As I say, like, they're just these ancient, glorious things. Mm. And yeah, that's it. Only on, like, 2 continents, like, if you count Madagascar, 3rd place as well, that's it. Mm. So
I adapted The Little Prince. Yeah. Yeah. And in it, there was a baobab tree in my adaptation as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I hope to do another production of that. Okay, should I read?
Yes, please.
I don't know. Just tell me when to stop.
Okay.
If you want. Because, okay. Or maybe I'll...
Should I just throw this?
Yes. Okay. Or maybe I'll stop. Wait.
So you know the bit when they're racing?
Yes.
And he arrives, just stop there.
When he arrives?
Yeah.
Okay, great. For thousands of years, gods enjoyed full dominion over the lives of men. From the northernmost poles to the southern, from the east of the sun's rise down to the west of the sun's set, men promised their souls and gave their all in penitent servitude. But this century marked a change. Their lives from soul god worshipped turned to fleshy pleasures and the glut of property. As prayers which fed and assuaged the might of gods dwindled, they felt their power cut. Zeus, who had been glorified on film, song, and stage, felt this keenly, grew vengeful, and sharpened his bolts. That lightning lord, that godfather, whose ancient rage once frightened king, whose influence, whose merest hopes were turned to laws and law supreme, realized too late this dwindling servitude of men and hurled bolts. He killed them. Other gods grew benevolent, cooled down, conserving power, but Zeus smote those who strayed from him, bolts asunder, this way, that. So thrice, through Shango's wide window, Zeus's terrible aim flayed the walls, and Shango had had enough, thundered, vexed, sped towards Mount Olympus. As he charged, his way was watched by other thunder gods, from Egypt, Set, Shak, Mayan, Indra, Hindu, from China, Fenglong, Wahatiri, Maori, Thor, Norse god, and the rest, too numerous to count, watched Shango's raging run towards Olympus, knowing chaos would come. Shango's first bolt hit the doors with such force, Hera's throne spun. Hera, queen of the Greek gods, screamed to Apollo, god of archery, to take arms against Shango, as Ares, god of war, sat back and watched the show. Artemis, goddess of hunting, grasped her longbow, but Shango burned it to ashes, his black fire wild in his hand. Thank you.
And I wanted to talk about the symbolism of that as well. So what was going through your mind when... I know we talked about it on one level, which is you had these influences of the Greek pantheon and you wanted to link it. But do you think that perhaps something else was going on there? That war seems very striking. What's that about?
What are you referring to?
What's that about? What is Shango and Zeus?
Yeah.
Right? The fact that there's even some part in the when you go further along where Shango is said to be stronger than Zeus.
Yes.
Right. So what were you thinking of there? What was going on through your mind? Why is Shango stronger than Zeus?
Because he is. And what I mean is, sometimes I try to lend some sort of logic to how gods work, right? Greece is a very small island compared to, you know, the bodies in Nigeria. And if it's prayers that feed gods and gods get, you know, strengthened by their followers, then the numbers alone will mean that Shango's many times stronger. So I was just thinking maybe a little bit about that. Yeah, I think maybe it's simply just a numbers game. But also, I was thinking of goodwill and everything that Shango represents versus everything Zeus represents. Mm-hmm. Zeus has vastly more enemies than Shango does. True. You know. So I was also thinking about it, a sort of metaphysical, karmic level. Yeah.
And I did wonder about the influences, obviously, of... I mean, we've talked about the Tree of Life, the Garden of Eden, and the baobab trees that are falling down everywhere for various environmental and man-made reasons. But I mean, I wanted to talk about the importance of nature in both your books.
Yeah.
Water, everything. Yeah, yeah. You know, and in Dazzling, it's very much trees as well, because in Igbo culture, it's not the baobab tree that's considered sacred. It's the silk cotton tree.
Yeah, yeah.
The silk cotton tree is the portal through which you can reach the spirit world, and it's also the portal through which the spirits can come into our world.
Yeah.
So what do you think was your massive, like, natural anchor? I know what yours is because you already said. But what was your anchor in, what was the, why was it set so? Because it's set in a world that is very devoid of urban trappings.
Yeah. It starts in a little village in Southwest Nigeria, then goes to America, LA specifically. Then he begins to play professionally for the Golden State Warriors. And then it comes to the 2012 Olympics in London. And then it goes to Mount Olympus and then ends back in Southwest Nigeria. It all came from the nickname. So the title itself, The Half God of Rainfall, came from a line in a poem. When I was in Nigeria, I dated. I went to school with four weirdos. Oh, why did I say dated? That's
you started this whole conversation with dating somebody. Yeah. Like, this is why, it, yeah. You know, it's cyclical. You've just come to the end of it.
Yeah, I was one of four, and we all had weird party tricks. Mine was that I could draw very well. I used to draw people in the sand. Another guy could fart the national anthem. It was, you could hear the melody was ridiculous. Another guy could eat hands full of sand, and I don't know, and his teeth would be perfect. I don't know. But the third guy, he could do incredible things with his own saliva, as in he could spit it 10 feet in the air and catch it in his own mouth. It was kind of gross. But in this poem I wrote about these four individuals, I called him the half god of rainfall. And that's where the title came. Right. And my poetry teacher said, this is amazing. This is a great image, half god of rainfall. And then years later, when I began to riff on that character. Now, in basketball, when you are able to shoot well, they say you can make it rain. So that's when I thought, okay, I'm going to have this half god of rainfall who's also the rain man on the basketball court. Mm. So water became just part of how I began to think of him. And when I considered where his water powers might come from, then his mother became a high priestess of the river goddess. So water became really the primordial element in the story. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's water with me as well, and there's a tree, and there's a tree with me as well.
Yeah, and there's lots of water as well, and because there's gods.
Of course.
I try and get across all the different terrains, basically. Like every place that appears in this book was actually on a really old map of Yorubaland pre-colonial times. Mm. Where I've taken liberties, though, is, you know, I don't know how important said places were. Probably many people living don't as well, because history wasn't really recorded on paper back then, so everything was talked, oral tradition, word of mouth, right? Yes. But the landscapes are really important, obviously. So I tried to get from, you know, a fishing village called Mahin, which is on the map there in this pre-colonial times, but doesn't exist anymore. Ikire, which is the village in which the story begins, where Coyote is from, a place called Abiji, and which is where the warrior princess Tiwa comes from, and then eventually also going to these mountains. Again, symbolism of mountains, right, and its conquest. So it's interesting that there is that literal. So it all plays a part. Yeah. So the natural world, but as well for me, like I enjoy hiking. So I live in Manchester, but I like having the convenience of a city, but also living very close to the peaks. Lake District's not that far away as well. And I love just being out in nature. There's this kind of wrong like assumption that always puts black folks in the UK and US especially in these urban spaces. But actually, when you travel to Africa, when you travel to Jamaica, went last year to do research for the next book, and went out to the Blue Mountains, and you see people just living off of the land, living
in
freely
the country,
in where they feel most happy. Yeah, and I kind of really resonate with that, because I find it just rejuvenating, mental health is better, and just enjoy being around. I love trees. Like, I actually like say that quite a lot to my partner. It's like, aren't trees great? It's just like, Ashley, you need to get over your love of trees. So yeah, all of that kind of plays a part in like why this is, the landscapes appear so much and are very important to the story. So
yeah, they're actually like a character. Like almost another character in the story.
Plays a part in like often the strengths or weaknesses of the Orishas as well, right? So yeah, a lot of things like that are played with in the story as Coyote and his companions go across to try and take on the gods one by one.
Are there gods in the next book? You said research for the next book, and I couldn't help.
Yeah, I was looking at so that's actually set in, because it's a standalone, they're both standalones. So yes. That's actually set in a fantastical version of Jamaica. And it imagines what would have happened if the Maroons actually had the black magic that the British were afraid of and used magic to drive them out. So it takes place some years later. And what would that world look like?
So it's Afrofuturist-ish. Is it
symbolically set in 1962 still, but it's a different future path that would have happened.
It's like a parallel universe.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a
yeah.
of a multiverse.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah.
And what are you working on next, Inua?
I'm trying to find time to work on a book of poems. My last book of poems was called The Actual Fuck. It came out in 2020. That's what it's called, yeah. So I'm think the next book of poems will be called Of All the Boys. And I like to create structures in which I work. So the poem in which the title comes from, The Half God of Rainfall, that poem is called Of All the Boys of Plateau Private School, which is the school I attended when I lived in Lagos, Nigeria. Now, I'm going to use that poem and the lines, the 55 lines in that poem, as titles for all the poems in a book called Of All the Boys. So I have all the titles, none of the poems. So what I'm trying to do is try
it's a process.
It's a process.
It's a process, it's
a process. Yeah.
So does anybody have any questions? Because we're not talking about what I'm doing next. We're not talking about it. You're going to ask me? Am I going to read
it? Yes.
But there's no time. Don't you want to have questions? I'm sorry. I didn't actually think about it. I was too busy trying to hear everything from everybody
just
else.
Just read something.
Okay, I'll read chapter 3 because everyone seems to like chapter 3. I'll read about 10 lines. Would that do?
No.
Excellent.
10 lines. That's half a page.
Treasure. Chapter 3. Treasure, then. I see the woman dodge into the shop, and I know her immediately. Mommy and daddy's friends, them, have all vamoosed, but me, I will never forget them. Mommy used to say I have bad heart, because if you do me bad, I will do you back. God no go vex. And this woman, she did me and mommy bad. Common shop cannot hide her keep. If she likes, she should run to Kafanchan today. Me, I will follow her in her back, in her back. Her name is Mrs. Umbachi, Mama Ojunwa. Me and Uju, her last born, used to be friends before. Mrs. Umbachi then will come to our house, she and her husband. I don't know his name. I used to call him Uncle or Papa Oju. He liked to drink Seaman aromatic schnapps and pour libation on the carpet because he carries chieftaincy title. Mommy would boil and mud her face frowning. After they left, she made Mercy our house help that time to scrub the carpet with elephant blue and brush. She used to point in Daddy's face with her yellow fingers like uncooked shrimps. Bia this man. Don't be bringing these poor people to come and spoil my carpet for me. And Daddy would throw his head back and laugh because he likes when Mommy does as if she is scolding him, even though they are always doing love. Daddy will pinch her cheeks and call her Ikebe Super, his hailing name for her, because he said he can perch on her bum-bum and she will just be walking and not know that he is there. Then he will beat her on the thing, bah, like that. Mommy will pretend to be vexing until he drops something for her. And I knew I was getting a new dress and shoes and bag to match after escorting Mommy shopping to spend the money. And maybe even dance cook for hamburger and ice cream for me and cream soda for Mommy. Oh. Thank you.
Just the range of voices you have is really astonishing and just how perfectly observed and captured they are.
I remember
when I was a kid and I talked like that. And I miss it because I've been corrupted by the Britannica Encyclopedia or whatever.
Yeah.
It was
and the
so
British Council.
Yes. But it was so familiar to read it. It just felt so rich. So thank you.
Thank you.
It just takes you back to your world, you know, to Africa. And sometimes we wish we had that kind of sense of belonging. Mm. I mean, I was born in Jamaica. My sister, my cousin. But you know what? We love reading. We love books. And the whole thing, we once went to see a play about the god Shango.
Mm-hmm.
And for us, it's still there. Mm. That, the essence of our own being is within your culture because it's also mine as well.
Mm.
And thank you for sharing.
Mm. And listen, I always extend this invitation to anybody. You can be Igbo if you want. It's very easy. I will take you to my village chief and tell him, okay, oh, look, somebody is back. And that's it. That is it. You know, we say in Igbo culture, Iwada Junwaju, we don't reject anyone. You know, you are me, I'm you. You didn't ask to be taken away. So come back, please. Yeah.
Hi, thank you so much. I want to know more about how you conducted your research. So you mentioned that you went to Jamaica for your next one. Did you all go back to Nigeria? And what were the most helpful resources that you read?
I didn't go back to Nigeria anywhere but in my mind. In fact, going to Nigeria would have been detrimental to the process because Nigeria is a very fast-changing environment. And the last time I went was 2017, and I remember just, no, because there were so many new things over where the old things in my memories were, and it was very perplexing. Mm. And everybody was like, look at it. We have pedestrian bridge. And it's like, no, I don't want a pedestrian bridge. I want to be able to cross the road and just feel like you're at risk because there's a lorry coming. And if you make it, you're alive. But then you can't resent them for those economic and infrastructural advancements because it makes life easier. And I've come from here to tell them to not have that. Who am I? So I did a lot of my research with calling my sister and saying, hey, do you remember when? And she's like, oh, yeah, this happened or whatever. And I think also because I did my first degree in Nigeria, there's a strong sense of place still because I was 16 to 20 when I did my degree. And at that point, you're like a young adult, aren't you? So for me, it was more like staying away and trying to hold on to the memories I had. That was the extent of my research. And also like calling my sister and doing some little book readings and stuff to remind myself.
For me, I found myself in a writer's retreat, and they had a small book about the Greek gods, which I stole. Yes.
I think the lack of sleep is affecting what you're saying here.
I'm just being brutally honest.
I'm sorry. I think need to sleep.
When I went back to the writer's retreat, I bought a new one and replaced it, yes. But yeah, because the copy that they had there was tattered, it was falling apart. No one had read that thing in 20 years, and the writer's retreat had been existent for much longer than that. So, you know, I was doing them a favor by taking it and getting another one. So I took that. What else? I researched a lot into basketball mythology. There are lots of books written about gods and demigods and specifically urban philosophy in America, in the South of America, and what basketball meant to communities, to black people there. So that really helped me tap into the potential spirituality, and then I added everything else. I read a lot about the Chinese have some like 1,000 thunder gods, just them alone. So read lots of philosophies and books about other thunder gods, just to get a sense of the pantheon I was writing into. What else? A lot. I got in touch with an Orisha priestess who I met in a writer's festival years before. She's now very active on Instagram. So I asked her questions. She'd tell me to do this, tell me not to do so. I met with a Shango initiate in Nigeria, in London, who's also a musician. And we came to heated arguments because he didn't like what I was doing with Shango. For him, I was making Shango less masculine than how he presents in all of the myth. Mm-hmm. But he went and consulted with Shango, and Shango told him to let me do what the fuck I was doing.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of research. I spoke to priests and initiates. But also, because of my book, I needed to learn about everything, how law plays into men who are accused of sexual abuse, and just the stats of who gets off and who doesn't, which were disgusting. I spoke to lots of female friends of mine who themselves were victims of sexual abuse just to understand what would contribute towards a woman's decision on what to do with her abuser as well. I just needed to figure out where my masculinity plays into ideas of justice and vengeance. So lots of really delicate conversation with friends of mine, and
I would say my research was started off unintentional when I was finding out about Virisha. So unlike my two panelists, like I didn't really have my formative years in Nigeria. I had them in the UK and my whole life experience is UK. And it's a very, very different experience when it comes to the being socialized as being black, which you just, you know, in Nigeria, you just are. Mm. there isn't that kind of social construct of race that there is here. And that obviously plays a part in perception, especially self-perception. And yeah, you just don't learn black history in school. So my young adult years were basically spent just, yeah, trying to get that connection back, really, to the continent. I was very Pan-African. I was listening to a lot of Tribe Called Quest and watching Spike Lee movies and stuff. So I just really wanted to kind of feel in my soul like I belonged in a way that sometimes didn't always feel like I did here. And yeah, among the things I researched were the Orishas, but I wasn't intending to write about them at the time. It was only some years later, I think it was 2017 maybe, where I got the idea of a boy versus gods. I was like, what states can be higher than going up against literal deities, right? Mm. And I began to think about, now here's a good opportunity to actually then just revisit the Orishas and bring that in. And a lot of the research I then went back into formed the process of how I came to write the book. So a lot of the characteristics of the gods in the actual lore itself are directly influencing how they behave in this and the ways to defeat them, spoiler alerts, and stuff as well. But then when it came to the actual place, well, it's pre-colonial Nigeria or what would become known as Nigeria. So it's kind of difficult to, I couldn't go to Nigeria without having completely different experience from how it would have been. Even back in Read Things Fall Apart and stuff like that, massive changes even then, 70 odd years ago. So it just depended on just trying to read as much diverse research as possible about it. But then also just my experiences with friends as well. Like I've had more than enough Nigerian meals and things like that. Food plays a large part in this. So I'm drawing on all the delicious experiences that I've had with my friends and just general different experiences of being in a culture where it seems to be less centered on the individualistic, which I'd say like here and Western world in general, it kind of is. And it's more about a community thing. And that's kind of at the heart of this book, really. One of the main takeaways I think would be like just collective power versus tyranny and what happens when people come together, when tribes come together. So all of that kind of just informed it. And it was very easy to write when I came to write it, which was end of 21, like 6 months into 2022 as well.
Nice. How far are you away from finishing the other novel?
So it's done. I'm editing right now. I'm trying to edit right now, but I've got to promote this book. And the work's also pretty hard right now. Yeah. So I'm in when I go back to my hotel room tonight, I'll probably just get back to that draft again. So
you're going to sleep. That's what you're going to do.
I have one question for you guys. Do we have time for a question? Yeah. If you could create a new god, what would be its powers? It's going to be playful or serious. Oh. Yeah.
I hate you.
I'm just going to try and answer very quick and not overthink it.
Okay.
But I feel like it's basically Oren Miller. So if I had all knowledge and all wisdom and all the conflicts, you could just end.
No. Not which god would you be.
But I have it.
No, that's not. I'm not asking which god would you be.
Which god would you create?
If you had to create a new god.
I would create one that's all just has the wisdom to say, like, you guys just get it together. Like,
I really don't know. I don't know, but I think it will be something very specific and very niche.
Yeah.
And very, very vengeful. Because I feel so angry all the time. I think adulthood was one of the biggest tricks that our parents and birth and life has played on us. Mm-hmm. So I think that there will be a lot of fire, brimstone, and vengeance, and it will be a deity that is female or probably female, because I relate very strongly with the female experience, and I have a lot of anger. Mm-hmm. I'm divorced. So, something like that.
Yes,
is what I think I would create, but I don't know yet, so I don't
want
to.
I mean, a goddess of divorce sounds bad.
The goddess of restitution in divorce.
Yes, specifically.
That would be it. Like, attack.
I mean,
go.
Her initiates are exploding across the world right now.
Do you
know
what I mean? Like, I just
the rate of divorces.
And be like, ah.
Yeah.
And she'll just attack.
That's what I want. Gods are always so dramatic.
That's the thing. Also, you have to be specific when you want to ask them for things, because it could be one of those boomerang things where you say, may this person disappear from my life. And she's like, oh, you want to die then? Bet. Boop. Mm-hmm. You know? So I think
I feel like her court, her church would be like a courtroom for divorces.
Yeah. I see that.
You see that?
Yeah, I see that.
And she's dressed as a judge or something.
Yeah. Or like a ring. Like a boxing ring, something abstract, something abstract, you know. But it's like for Muay Thai or like or kickboxing, something like gritty, something gritty. Except she's also sitting on a flower, but she's like sweaty. But she's,
I love that.
So she has both sides.
Great goddess. She can reconcile
both sides. Yeah. Thanks for this. I think I'm gonna have that tatted on now. give my parents something else to worry about.
Okay.
Well, thank you, everyone, for coming. It's been so wonderful having you here. And if you have any questions, you can catch me and maybe Ashley. I think Inwa is on his way out.
Do we have books here to sign?
Yeah, I think we do. Yes.
We'll be outside. We'll be outside.
Thank you so much, Inwa LM.
Thank you.
Ashley Top, Chico de Malamado. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. The 2025 Bradford Literature Festival starts on the 27th of June with a huge programme of events, from comedy to crime, music to memoirs. Head to bradfordlitfest.co.uk to book your ticket now.